Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today is associate editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Today we will be talking about recent comments from Steven Spielberg and George Lucas about how the movie industry is headed towards, I quote, an implosion. The reason that they said this was they felt that it's getting harder and harder to make films that are outside of a blockbuster range. And so, to quote Spielberg precisely, there's eventually going to be an implosion or a meltdown. There's going to be an implosion where there are three or four or maybe even a half dozen mega budget movies are going to go crashing into the ground, and that's going to change the paradigm. And what they believe will go from there is that there will be fewer movies, and that the ones that are blockbusters that go to the theater will be premium. So there will actually may even be a different pricing model based on the film you're seeing. So if you go see This Is the End, that will cost you $10. But if you go see Man of Steel, that'll cost you $30, because there will be this new upcharge to sort of make up for the blockbuster, to make blockbusters even more feasible. And if you charge a lot for them, the thinking is, well, then they'll be the premium. It's like everyone's going to go see Iron Man 3, so we can charge more for Iron Man 3 as opposed to another film in our theater.
Well, and we've already seen it happening. World War Z had you could buy the mega ticket from Paramount for World War Z.
I will say, though, that's at least creative. I will say that, because what if – I don't know how well it worked for World War Z, and I wish we could see some numbers on that, but it's kind of an interesting idea, because it doesn't necessarily change the pricing model. A World War Z ticket still costs the same, but if you wanted to get in on that early screening, and you got a bunch of other stuff for you, like you got a digital download code as well, and
and a small popcorn, collector's 3D glasses.
Exactly, you got a bunch of shit for, I think it was still too much money. It was like, what, $50 or something, $35?
Yeah, it was $50. Which, if you have a family of four, like,
that's not a sad loner who's like, I want my Brad Pitt glasses and my downloadable copy of World War Z. But that's a good point, though, about the family of four. We don't think about the family of four and these sort of rising ticket prices. And George Lucas was saying how he thinks it's going to be closer to he thinks theaters are going to become more like Broadway, where you pay a lot of money to go see a movie. Like, you pay a lot of money, but you don't go often. Everything mostly comes into the home. So Broadway's the exception. I take exception to that comment for a few reasons. I don't think the Broadway model would work, because if it were going to work, it would have to, the entire theater itself would have to change. You'd have to build new theaters, not just multiplexes, because part of the Broadway experience is also, it's very well regulated in terms of, you don't get to like break out your phone at a Broadway show and just get away with it. They will kick your ass out. And also, tickets are priced differently based on where you're sitting. And that matters when it's a live performance and you want to be closer to the action. It doesn't matter if it's a screen, and honestly, most of the seats are worth the same. But I will say, even if the prices do increase, let's just go by what Spielberg was saying. And he says you're paying like $25 for Iron Man 3. And then you have a family of four. So just to get them in the door, for a $25, that's $100 right there before the popcorn, which is where theaters make their money. They're really just junk food dispensaries that happen to show movies. That's how theater chains like Regal and AMC operate. They don't really give a shit about the consumer experience, which is why they've become so terrible at projecting movies and making sure people behave like human beings, or at least with respect towards others. It's just, it's all getting lost. And I want to say up front, and then I'm going to actually let Adam speak, and as opposed to just have him sit here and be like, why am I even? He's just going to talk to himself for the whole hour.
Fucking Goldberg.
I want to say this, and I know it's strange. I get so worked up over movie theater etiquette and the death of movie theaters, and I look at it, and I feel passionately about it. And then I take a step back and it's like, there are so many better things in the world I could care about. There are so many actual problems in the world. It's like, do you want to focus on, you know, terrible starvation or how small communities in Africa can't get clean water? No, because people can't, they don't turn off their cell phones in the movie theater, and so I'm going to focus all my energy on that one annoyance. So I do understand in the grand scheme of things that this is a bit overbearing, and yet at the same time, I am a film critic, and I have a great respect for the art form. And so, yes, in the grand scheme of things, this is a minor thing, but to me, it is still important. So I just wanted to relay that. Adam, do you think I'm being over... indulgent on this one?
Well, I mean,
if so, say yes, and we'll just end the show now.
Yes.
All right.
Well, I generally reject the premise that I don't necessarily agree with Spielberg and Lucas's predictions. I don't think that we're in for like an implosion. I mean, you can see in the rest of that interview, they complain about how they had trouble getting their movies made. So I think part of it comes from just kind of being out of touch. Like I don't think Spielberg's been, I mean, Spielberg's a great filmmaker, but he hasn't always been on the cusp of like cutting edge things. He's delved into TV, but his TV, like the On the Lot reality show, like he hasn't really bet on the right horses, so to say. And I don't really trust that they know exactly what's going on. Some of that interview kind of reads like they're a bit sour about how, I mean, Spielberg said Lincoln was this close to becoming an HBO movie, which, I mean, of course it's a really expensive movie because it has that huge cast. It has to have the production value, and Spielberg has to get paid his quota. Like he's not going to drop his director fee that much. So it's an expensive movie, and I mean, it made a lot of money, which I don't think most studios saw happening, but he had a lot of trouble getting the movie made because a lot of studios weren't keen on making a period drama, whether it was directed by Steven Spielberg or not. But I don't know. I don't really agree that the people are going to be just shut-ins and stay at home and watch all of their movies and stuff on demand and on TV. I know that there is an increase of people doing that, but I mean, just going to the movies this week and Monsters University came out, it was a madhouse. Like my sister went to try and go see it, and when you have Man of Steel, World War Z, which did much better than expected, and Monsters University, this is Man of Steel's second weekend, but, and also This Is the End had a really strong hold. Like, I read that, you know, movie theaters are dying, people aren't going to see movies, but then I go out and it's packed. Like everyone, there are always going to be movies that people are going to want to go out to see. And I think we sometimes lose sight of the fact that like we're in this business, and we, and probably most of the listeners listening to this are cinephiles. So they're paying attention and they see a lot of movies every year. They see a lot of, they know what's coming out each weekend. They know which weekends they're going to the theater. But for a lot of people, they wait until there's something that they're really looking forward to or something that really catches their eye. And then they'll go out for it. And so that's what studios are trying to make, because they don't have a lot of money to spend and they don't pay as much attention. They're not looking for the next Martin Scorsese movie. They're looking for, you know, a good time or a movie that they think is going to be interesting and fun. So I don't think we're close to something happening like Spielberg and Lucas are saying. Spielberg's comment that you could be paying more for certain movies maybe makes a little more sense, but they've already, I mean, they've done the 3D ticket hike, which throws everything way, makes everything way more expensive. And they're doing everything they can to make you see it in 3D. Every time I try to look up showtimes, there's twice as many showtimes that are in 3D than are in 2D. But I guess it would cost more to see Iron Man 3, but I feel like there would be a lot of public upheaval, a lot of people angry about the fact that they're charging more for one movie as opposed to another one.
See, I just think, though, what you're saying, though, kind of reinforces it, because if you look at it this way, let's assume that Hollywood gets out of the business of making all the small films like Lincoln, and they're just like, this is TV's thing now. So if anything under a certain budget that is in this amount of range, just send it to TV, send it to HBO, send it to cable networks, just send it that way. And then we'll take on all the films that cost hundreds of millions of dollars, event movies, and there'll be fewer films, but we'll charge more for them. So let's say these people aren't cinephiles, okay? They're not going to the movie theater every week. So then wouldn't it be conceivable that, say, if I'm only going to go see a couple movies this summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm average Joe moviegoer. They just go, and in their thinking is, well, if I'm only going to see a couple movies this summer, why not pay $30? Like, that'll be my thing. Like, I'm going to only see these two movies, so that's $30, rather than see six movies for $10, you know? Rather, just bet on these two films. And he's just like, these are the ones I'm going to go to. Because, I mean, Spielberg is also saying that he sees a string of bombs coming. And you don't know when those are going to land. I don't think it's just a matter of a watershed flop season. I think it's really going to be something that slowly just keeps coming on, where people have so many entertainment options that the box office is just going to be slowly worn away on the whole, where people are just going to be like, you know what, I'm going to wait 3 months and see this at home in the private. I'm going to see it cheaper. I'm going to see it on a bigger I'm going to see it in the privacy of my home on a nice TV. I won't have to deal with lines. I won't have to deal with rude patrons. I won't have to deal with shitty projection.
And it's cheaper. You only pay one ticket.
Exactly. And it's cheap. Yeah, I'll have everyone over, and for $5, we're all going to watch it. And yeah, it won't be the big screen experience, but how good is that experience when theaters are shooting themselves in the foot with poor projection and, you know, allowing people to talk and text during the screening? I love movies. I love going to movies, but I've reached the point where I don't like going to movies outside of press screenings, because at press screenings, they'll lay the hammer down and, like, actually throw people out. Not because it's rude, but because they are afraid of piracy and therefore think any light may be trying to record the film. But hey, whatever, I don't give a shit. But outside of that, if I go to a movie now, I will not go on the opening weekend. What I will do is I will wait a couple weekends, and then I will go to the first showing on a weekday or a weekend, the matinee showing, and I will show up, and I'll be the only one in the, like, me and, like, maybe a few other people, and that's it. So I basically have the theater to myself just to avoid having to deal with people who are rude. Because even at press screenings, people turn on their phones, like, because it's rarely enforced. Oops, secret. It should be more enforced, but even people in the press section, like, turn on their phones and check shit, and it's like, short attention span theater. People just forgot how to behave because they're treating it like they're in their own home. They're treating this movie theater, this public space, like, oh, I just don't, they just don't get it anymore. The behavioral pattern has changed. The way something that used to be unthinkable and rude is now accepted, and so now that's the norm. And personally, and maybe this is just as a cinephile speaking, I don't want to be a part of that. I mean, when you go to the movies, like when you pay to go to the films, what is your experience like? Because I know in Tulsa, I have no trouble believing that people would be rude. And
yeah, I mean, it varies. And there are, like, we have four or five different theaters, and we have an independent theater. And, like, the independent theater is great. Like, they enforce it like no other. But, you know, you kind of have to pick and choose. I go to a Cinemark most often. There's a Cinemark and an AMC, and those both have really good projection, and they're really, you know, bright screens and everything. But I would say it varies. I kind of go crossing my fingers, like, oh, I hope I'm not. It's come to the point now where I know there's going to be someone on their phone. I just hope they're not in my line of sight. And I don't like to sit super close to the screen, so I try and, like, I weigh my options, like, the farther back I am, like, the more people I'm going to see that have, you know, their phones out. And, you know, it is annoying. It gets on my nerves, too, and it's a manner of etiquette. But I feel like that's a larger cultural shift that's happening. It's not just in movie theaters. If you go to any restaurant, like, you wouldn't, like, think of someone, like, bringing a magazine to the dinner table, that, like, if you're going out to eat with a bunch of people, but everyone's on their phones at the dinner table. And that's kind of, I don't know, that annoys me too. And I know it's not as big a deal for a lot of people, and it's fine if you're, like, checking your phone for stuff, but it seems like when people are waiting for the food, you look around, everyone has their phones out, and they're kind of barely talking to each other.
Oh, it's definitely a society thing. I mean, we could go on in that. It's just in the movie theater, like, at dinner, like, that's just people at your table. And, like, the thing with the movie theater is you're sort of trapped. Because you can't, if you tell them to turn your phone off, then you're part of the distraction, and then they might not do it. You might see I had this one situation, and it was horrible. This is like the water. This was the experience that made it like I will never go see a movie, a blockbuster film on opening weekend night ever again. So I went to go see X-Men First Class with some friends. I had already seen it, but I went to go see it with some friends. We're watching it. already, from the get-go, it was terrible. The projectionist couldn't figure out that the little pre-show thing, that thing, you know, it ends and then the projector goes on and the other thing goes away and then the trailer show. Couldn't figure out how to get the other one to go away. So we were stuck with that. Then it was fuzzy. And then there's some douchebag. See, I was up way near the top because that's where our seat, that's where they chose to sit. Way near the top. Some dude way down below. Light just, I had, it was like, for me, it was like a spotlight going up. And I went all the way down. I asked him to turn it off. He laughed in my face. I went, got security, had them tell. It's like, and then I would never have done any of this if I hadn't already seen the film. I would have just like sucked it up and been like, time at the movies. And that's just wrong. Like, it's just a shitty experience. At least I can understand it's rude at like the dinner table, but like, at least then you can just tell someone, do the phrase, hey, can you not, can you put the phone down and let's have a conversation.
That, but still, there's, I mean, there's something to be said for going to a packed house and seeing this is the end. Like, I really want to see, like, comedies like that, or that's a communal experience, or even a movie like The Avengers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But you also, again, have to, like, pick and choose. So, for instance, if I want to go see The Avengers, I paid to see The Avengers in 2D, but my mandate was we are seeing this opening night, like the midnight screening, because mm-hmm. that is an audience that will self-police. Like, no yeah. one there is interested in what's on their phone. Everyone there is into the movie.
I've just gotten to the point now where, like, I mean, I will complain if someone's around me, but I've gotten to the point where I just have to deal with the fact that people are going to use it. It's become a thing. Like, it's – theaters aren't going to be – they can't be in every – well, they won't be in every screening to watch, and they won't enforce – the phone policies. It shouldn't be on the audience. I don't want to have to miss part of the movie that I paid to see to go and complain on someone that's using their phone.
And
that's shitty.
And honestly,
like,
I think if that ever happens, if someone's talking on their phone, you should just go to the management and be like, I want my money back. I want.
Yeah.
No, seriously,
yeah.
Because it's not my job to patrol. And if you can't afford an usher to go in and periodically check to say, hey, it's people on their phones, like, if that, then I want my money back. Like, it's not my job to leave the theater and go tell you. You're supposed to make this an experience where I can enjoy the film. Otherwise, why bother with any of it? Why show it in focus? Why have the speakers work? Why do any of it?
Yeah. And can you imagine, though, paying $35 to see, like, Iron Man 5 and, like, people are on their phones?
Motherfuckers would get up then. See, and that's the other thing. At that point, people have paid $35 and motherfuckers aren't going to – the tolerance level will be non-existent. At $10, people are like – yeah, it just comes with it. At $35, people are like, I will kill you. They will.
But that's the thing. A lot of people don't think it's a big deal. Like,
I know
that the problem is, like, I saw I can't remember what I saw. I saw Man of Steel with a group of people, and someone that I'm kind of friends with was sitting next to me, and they were kind of like making jokes throughout the film. But like, I think people don't like some people go to films with different. Like experiences. Some people are like, oh, this is like, it's a movie, it's an escape, I'm just gonna go, but I want to soak it all in, and I want to be like wrapped up in like the emotional beats that are happening. I don't want someone like cracking jokes or like talking. But a lot of people just go to the movie thinking it's fine, like it's just a movie, as they would say, and so they're not worried about someone down there is like pulling them out of the movie, because they don't really have any idea that like the people who took 2 years and worked tirelessly to put this together made every single beat and every single music cue and emotional beat that happens on purpose to elicit a response from you, the audience member. And if you're pulled out of that, it pulls you out of the movie and you've lost it. And they don't understand that. They just come to it thinking like, oh, it's just, I'm just going to enjoy it. And like, if someone's on their phone, whatever, like it's just something there. It's like, I'm in my living room. They would say,
well,
it's
just a movie.
And that infuriates me.
Well, but if it's just a movie and it's just that, and that's just the thing, then where's the line for someone to say, wait, okay, if it's just a movie and I don't care that much and I just want to hang out with friends to watch this, why am I driving out to this place, parking, paying more, buying concessions when I could just be patient for 3 months unless it's like the big event movie and I'll just stay home? Like, there's increasing – if the product doesn't have value and if you're not treating it like it has value and if it's just mundane, then the behavior you're bringing into the movie theater eventually – you're going to process like, wait, I'm driving and paying more for no reason. Everything I want to do, I can do at home and do so with less hassle. And the factor of it's rude to other people hasn't even entered into this thought process. I am thinking as a purely selfish person would think, which is, I can save money and be a dick at home. And it's true. And look, I understand that the way we're living now, we are almost, I don't want to say programmed, but I know for one, like, I don't have the world's longest attention span sometimes. It's embarrassing. I watch, if there's stuff, like if there's a baseball game on TV, you know, I'll be looking at my phone, or what's on my TV doesn't always have my full attention. And if I'm watching a movie, I actually have to take my other devices and put them in another room. And so I won't be tempted to, like, while I'm watching a movie, to also be checking my phone. Like, it's, and sometimes it's like some shit's just background. Like, I'm not going to give 100% of my attention to season two of Deep Space Nine. I'm sorry. It's not that good. I'm going to play Bejeweled on my phone while it's playing. Not everything deserves my full attention. I'm sorry. But I control the environment. But there are those distractions. And for me, why I don't want this implosion to come, but I'm afraid it's on its way, is I love going to movies so I can be lost and free from the distractions. The movie theater, as a physical place, has a power to transport, okay? It's just going into it and just that feeling. It's designed that way. It's a big black box with just the thing. They designed it that way for a reason. I mean, it's meant to echo the stage shows. That's why it's a stage up front and we're all looking in one direction. But the way it has grown from there, it's a dark room. You just lose yourself in it. And now when someone takes out their phone and now their light is coming out, it's like, I didn't come here for you. And what I'm coming for is being taken away. And I feel that we're going to lose it. I really don't believe theaters as we know them today will exist in 20 years, because there's enough blame to go around. I mean, it's, and not just blame, but I mean, there are good things. I don't want it to be like, if everyone hadn't turned out so shitty, we'd still have movie theaters. No, there's great programming on TV right now. There is amazing. If you had told me 5 years ago or 10 years ago that some of the best programs on television were on cable, like some of the best shows, and I'm like, well, yeah, AMC. I'm like, wait, AMC, the fucking showing Predator for the eighth time today? That AMC? Yes, that AMC. And it's true. And even other networks, like A&E has, like, Bates Motel, which I guess I've heard is great. That show's supposed to be really good.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. And
it's got great acting. That's the thing, is this is where – well, and this is another interesting point that Spielberg brings up. And I disagree with the fact, with people who are saying that theaters as we know them will be gone in 20 years. I mean, I'm just an optimist. I think there will always be that desire to go out and see movies, and there's too many of them. But Spielberg brings up the point that adult dramas are really hard to get made now, and a lot of those actors are moving to television. But what gives me hope is, I mean, you look at a movie like Flight. That is a pure adult movie that is made absolutely for adult audiences, and it did really, really well at the box office. And this fall, there's a movie coming out called Prisoners with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal and Viola Davis, just like a stellar cast, and it looks like to be just like a purely adult drama. It's rated R. It's made just for adults. They're not throwing in explosions or fight scenes or anything to bring the kiddos. It's a movie that was made specifically for adults. You can even look at – you could throw Argo into that mix. I feel like there's a lot of movie – like people are saying that they don't make movies for adults anymore, but I feel like there is still hope out there. Like Argo was not a small budget movie. People say there's only – movies that get made today are either made for 20, 30 million or like 150 million. But Argo had a budget of like 50, 60 million, I think. And that did really well. I feel like I know that a lot of people are moving to television because there's the allure of doing that long form storytelling, and a bunch of great writers are there and a bunch of great actors are moving there. Vera Farmiga is incredible on Bates Motel. I would stack that up against anything in movies. The show itself is okay, but Vera Farmiga is amazing on it. But I think there's room for both, and it gives me hope. We have movie like Lincoln. That's an adult movie that made so much money.
Well, wait, just stop. What define really well? Because I think that this notion of like it did really well, but in what marketplace? Because yes, there is like Argo took in $232 million worldwide. Lincoln took $275 million worldwide. The Flight took in 161 worldwide. But the current economy of it, in terms of marketing and where the revenue is coming from, is very different. I mean, there was an article on Salon earlier this week about how producers and studios, they don't know how to create their profit loss statements because the DVD market is gone. Like, they could at least count on that before for like 50% of our revenue is going to come from that, and that's gone now. So I'm sorry, but this notion of it did really well, the market is become too complex for that. And
what do you mean? I mean, a movie that made $161 million on a budget of 31. That's, I don't know how you say that's not.
I mean, it's not the success that they want. It's not in terms of leverage. Because if a studio only has X amount of dollars, and sadly they don't want the singles and doubles philosophies, what they want is, okay, so that movie, $31 million gets, let's say, are we talking about Flight? Is that the film?
Yeah, that's Flight.
Let's say advertising and all that stuff. From other revenue sources, like selling it to airplanes. I mean, they play Flight on airplanes, which is just mind-boggling to me. I thought that was against the law to be able to play movies like that on airplanes. But you can. They sold it to, you know, if you're on Delta and want to watch Flight for some ungodly reason, you can. And, you know, to hotels and all that shit. I would say, can we agree maybe $100 million? Would you say that it made $100 million? Not?
Yeah.
Okay. Compare that to a film like Iron Man 3. That film currently crossed $400 million at the box office, and it cost $400 million domestic. Right now it's pulled in $1.2 billion worldwide. It cost $200 million to make, and then let's say another $200 million to market. So 400.
I'm not arguing
so,
that.
Like, I mean, if
Iron
you look
Man
at the scale,
is,
but look at the scale. Like, that Flight.
I'm not. All I'm saying is that, like, these movies exist and they are still continuing to exist. Like, the adult drama is not gone.
It's not.
I'm not
gone.
Saying that it's a movie that studios are making a lot of.
So you,
or that it's a really profitable type of movie.
Are you saying,
I'm just saying
that
Spielberg
is like sour grapes? Then is that what?
It's what it. That's what it sounds like to me. I mean, it came off a little bit like that in the article when I read it, that, like, well, Lincoln was almost an HBO movie. Like, can you believe that? I mean, Soderbergh went to HBO for Behind the Candelabra, but it's easy once you see that movie to see why studios turned it down. But I think it was a wrong decision. But it's not an easily marketable film.
Well, and see, and that's the thing. I mean, if that's where the talent is going, in terms of what's easily marketable, you're always going to get that trick. I'm not going to say, like, man, movies used to be great and now, like, I would honestly say, in terms of quality, movies stay pretty consistent. I think that's sort of the beautiful thing about them. It's because no one knows the exact formula for how to make a good movie. If you could, they would only make good movies. But also, there's no formula. I mean, it's much easier to make a bad film, we'll say that. But I don't ever feel like there's a year it's like, man, there were no good movies this year and just went on my way. But I will say that it does get harder to push more original content. I mean, it was so weird. Earlier today, THR reported that Paramount is moving forward on a sequel to World War Z. But in the second paragraph of the article, they said, and I'm going to quote this, it was somewhere in the article, but it was basically opening paragraph. The tentpole earned $66 million in North America, the best opening for an original live-action tentpole since Avatar. That's not it's not an original film, though. It's based off a book. Because the studio wouldn't have...
I mean, it's basically an original
base film. Doesn't matter, but they took it... No, they took it based on a book. Okay? I understand that they didn't use pretty much any
of it.
That's just
poor reporting on...
It's poor reporting, but I mean, the point I'm trying to make is, when was the last time... The last time I can think of a huge blockbuster film that was based on an original concept was Inception.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that... Did Inception make less money on its opening weekend? Because...
Then 66, I don't know.
I'm checking the machine. This is the beauty of recording a podcast online. This might actually just be really shitty reporting on their part. their opening weekend. Nope, the opening weekend was $62 million on Inception.
Yeah.
So there you go. But at least Inception, that was like an original concept. But Inception is so rare. And the only way you can make a movie like Inception is if you make a movie like The Dark Knight. You have to make that movie to make the other movie. And I understand that Hollywood is risk averse. I get that. And, but also I feel that they are in sort of this mold where they're also trying to be conscious of budgets. I respect that as well. Like, we saw Paradise Lost just get canceled. There was also that, what was it, that Arthur and Lancelot film that got canceled. Mm-hmm. So they are trying to ease off the gas.
The Akira movie, like, Warner Brothers is, like, laying the hammer down.
And good on them. That being said, they did 47 Ronin, right? Is that ever? No, that's Universal.
Yeah, that's Universal.
Poor Universal. Actually, no, they had Fast and Furious. Fuck them. I mean, those are fine films, whatever. I meant fuck them in terms of I'm not going to weep for you having one of the most successful franchises today. But going back to the point of studios trying to be a little more frugal, at the same time you have Disney, who on the one hand is cranking out the biggest of all the successes. Like, Disney, to me, is the most powerful of all the studios. Because they have Pixar and Marvel
and Lucasfilm.
And, oh yeah, they're just Disney. By the way, they're Disney. They can come up with their own stuff, like Alice in Wonderland, you know?
And planes.
And planes. Back in my day, we'd send that one directly to video, as it was intended. But, goodness. But then again, you have a studio that tried to be really careful, and then you have The Lone Ranger coming up, and I think if Spielberg's talking about $250 million movie that's going to bomb, and granted, I'm terrible at predicting box office, but Adam, from your boots on the ground, have you heard any interest for Lone Ranger?
Just from myself and a couple other people who... I mean, I like Gore Verbinski
a lot. I like Gore Verbinski a lot, too, but the trailers just make it look good.
But what's going to sell that movie is international. You just put Johnny Depp on the poster, and then international wins it all. Pacific Rim is the one I'm most closely looking at because that could be – I love Guillermo, and I like him as a person, and I want it to do well. But I have not – like, no one I've talked to is interested in that movie, and it is not tracking well.
Really? It's not tracking well at all?
Yeah, from like the recent like reports have said like it's not – I mean, I don't have access to tracking, but I think Ann Thompson of – Thompson on Hollywood said that it wasn't tracking very well. Yeah. And then I think Variety or Deadline or something.
But see, even that, though, it's like we talk about, oh, it just needs a star. Well, it has to be a star in a certain kind of vehicle. Like, no one wants to go see Johnny Depp in a film based off a Hunter S. Thompson book. No one wants to go see The Rum Diary.
No one wants to see Will Smith in a giant sci-fi movie.
Exactly.
And, like, they hid M. Night Shyamalan's name from that like crazy, so it wasn't – I don't think it was him that it bombed. Like, and I think we live in the age now where the like a movie star is not a thing. I don't think it was Brad Pitt that sold World War Z.
You don't think it was Brad Pitt that sold World War Z?
No, I mean, I think he was part of it, but I don't think you can point to Brad Pitt as
the only reason.
Not as the person in the movie that sold it. Maybe him going to every single advanced screening across the country helped.
That did help, and also, I think internationally he sells, just like Tom Cruise, internationally sells very well.
Yeah.
There are stars who do that. That being said, though, I don't think After Earth is doing that well overseas.
Last I looked, I don't think it was.
Right, but I guess the comment I'm trying to make, though, is... Will people if Pacific Rim tanks? Yeah, After Earth has made $171 million worldwide, which is kind of disappointing when you look at how much it cost. Will people say, "Oh, Pacific Rim didn't have any stars, and that's why it didn't do well"? Like, are people going to say that or? Yeah,
I think nobody knows anything. I think they're going to try and point – I think after a movie comes out, everyone has an opinion on what happened.
Yeah, armchair quarterbacking and sometimes it's kind of –
if only they'd have listened to me.
Well, exactly. Although sometimes it's pretty clear. It becomes kind of clear in the aftermath. Yeah. Like Scott Pilgrim, it's like, wow, you did –
The marketing was awful.
I remember I showed it to my brother on DVD and he's like, this is a comedy? He didn't know that there was comedy in it. And it's just – so sometimes it's bad marketing. I think John Carter – was a victim of many. It was almost like a perfect storm of what caused that. But I like John Carter. I don't think it's an amazing film. But again, that's the kind of bomb that Spielberg is talking about. And I guess the question is how many of those can a year endure before studios change? And I will say this. He didn't exactly make it quite clear how that implosion would lead to increased ticket sales, as if, I guess, studios would make tickets cost more to cover their bets. But then again, theater owners have some say in that as well. I mean, theater owners are weird. The National Association of Theater Owners is a weird beast in terms of what they choose to care about and how little power they actually have. Like, we were talking about this earlier. It's like, you better not make trailers longer, or you better not start advertising your movie here until 4 months before it's supposed to come out. It's like, or else what? You'll do
yeah,
what?
Yeah, they can't really enforce
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's if they told Warner Brothers, like, hey, did you just start giving us longer trailers for Man of Steel? Don't show that shit around here. Don't bring it over into my theater where it will drive traffic for people to buy candy and soda and popcorn. But I guess it is kind of tough to see where he's going, but I just, and maybe it's, I'm the pessimist in this situation, but I feel that it's evaporating. It's the societal behavior, and it's, again, more draw for entertainment dollars. I mean, Spielberg and Lucas came up in a time where there wasn't anything on TV. TV was there, but it wasn't like everything. There wasn't, I mean, just in the past few years, Netflix and on demand, this notion that I can watch almost any movie I want just because I thought of it. Just because in the middle of the day, it's like, you know what I haven't seen in a while? This. I wonder if it's on Amazon streaming. It is. I'll watch it now. The notions of driving to the movie store, the rental store, the late fees, all of it. $3, movie I wanted to see, done. And that's if it's not on Netflix. And I look at all of that, and I say, and I think, if 3D ticket prices are already drying up, and I think we're starting to see that 3D is not driving ticket sales. I mean, it is. I mean, people are like, this is Brad Pitt's biggest opener. And it's like, yeah, but it also had 3D in it. So 3D does help, but it's not like in the wake of Avatar where 3D was just like must, you know, there was serious dollars. And
yeah, the percentage of people seeing movies in 3D has gone way down
in the US, but overseas now is where it's at.
Yeah, and also theater owners can rig the game by making more showings at 3D. So if something's inconvenient for you, or if you can only see it at this time, this has happened to me before, I have to see it in 3D because it's going to ruin my plans if I try to make this, like, the 2D showings are at, like, 11:50 in the morning and then, like, 2:30 and then at, like, 7 at night and then it's done. And then they have, like, 15 3D showings, so.
See, but I think that's going to start backfiring because, again, eventually people like you will be like, you know what, fuck it, I don't want to go. I don't want to pay the upcharge for a film that looks I don't want to pay more for a film that's going to look worse. That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, internationally, they're building so many theaters that have 3D projection. So there is a market for that 3D. And a lot of films that are getting this 3D post-conversion are because they want it. Like, it's all driven internationally. And that's a very important number to look at. We talk about domestic takes, and it's really such a small piece of the pie. What we really want to look at is internationally, and my hope, I'm not a complete pessimist, but I have a hope that movies will still keep getting 3D post-conversions, but, I mean, I expect them to keep getting 3D post-conversions, but my hope is that those 3D post-conversions will just be shipped overseas and we'll get fewer of them here until eventually it's just not feasible to give them to American movie studios, American movie theaters, because all they're doing is taking up space in a theater where if you had shown the 2D version, people would have, you probably would have sold more tickets. Because I think the fat is running
out. And to the point of, you know, the making less adult dramas and more kind of big budget and stuff, the thing that worries me the most is that, and it's not as much a worry, but that filmmakers are moving to television and taking that time out of their schedule that they're not able to make these big movies like, you know, David Fincher did House of Cards, and he only directed the first two episodes, but he was executive producer on that whole first season, was very involved, and that took up a lot of his time. Martin Scorsese spent a month filming the pilot for Boardwalk Empire. You've got Cary Fukunaga, who's doing like one of the most promising younger directors out there, basically took his next 2 years and decided to make True Detectives on HBO, which looks incredible. It's a 10-episode anthology series. But you've got these people who are just getting frustrated and don't want to deal with – I mean, when you look at someone who's Steven Spielberg who can't get his movies made, and this has been happening a lot recently for him, studios aren't like he picks his next project. You know, he's always got a bunch of things that he's juggling. But I know it happened on the Trial of Chicago 7. He had trouble getting financing for that, so that never happened. That never came to fruition, and that had a script by Aaron Sorkin. So you have these directors like that, and possibly even David Fincher. We know he's trying to get 20,000 Leagues done at Disney, but there's been a lot of kind of postponement on that, and then a lot has to do with the huge budget for it. And, you know, are they just going to get pissed off and just so frustrated that they just move straight into working on Cable?
Well, I'm surprised that Fincher – I'm not surprised, but the fact that he's willing to do another blockbuster film, he hasn't really done one.
Well, I think that's the point. He's never done one, and he's been developing 20,000 Leagues for a long time.
Right, and Alien 3 was a nightmare for him, and he's been developing 20,000 Leagues for a long time. The problem is that a blockbuster film isn't as conducive to his let me shoot 100 takes approach as a smaller film, because even, I mean, they just look over your shoulder more. I mean, Seth Rogen did an interview recently where he was like, man, Green Hornet was fucking terrible. Because he was saying, like, how they had never had that experience before because the movies they had made before they didn't cost as much money. You know, you make a movie for 20 or 30 million, studios like, you know, you make your 20, $30 million comedy, studios like, hey, go have fun, whatever. That's what This Is the End clearly was. They made it for 30 million, they had their free reign to do whatever, and they did it, and it's a hit. But Green Hornet cost like 100 million, and they were like being second guessed at every turn. And so, and they're just like, I mean, that's just Seth Rogen and Michelle Gondry. How does a studio, who has to be the poor schmuck from Disney who has to go tell David Fincher, stop doing so many takes? What poor asshole has to do that job? Because I don't want it ever. That would just be the worst.
Well, and I know Ben Button was difficult for him with Paramount. I know he kind of butted heads on that one. A bit as well, and I think also on Social Network, because that was with Sony.
Sony.
So, right. Yeah.
I mean, and again, it's not that he's not an easy guy, or it's just he's one of those guys that's very demanding and he knows what he wants, and mm-hmm. It's one of those things where there are other directors who just work better in the system, but and it's just, it's tough to say. Each director has their own personality, and you hope they get the best from him. I mean, I'm thrilled that Guillermo del Toro got to make Pacific Rim. I assume that what we see will probably be fairly close to his vision.
I think mostly because Legendary is involved, and Thomas Toll has been super involved with.
Yeah, he's been very supportive of Legendary has been pretty supportive of what their filmmakers want.
I think nowadays you have to be Christopher Nolan.
I
think you have to be Christopher Nolan to let people leave you alone. I think everyone else, like even Scorsese had trouble getting Silence made.
Well, see, so that's the thing. We're looking at these directors who, you know, like Scorsese and Spielberg. Well, Spielberg, you know, hadn't had a hit in a long time, and mm-hmm. Scorsese was never about cracking out blockbusters. He's a respected auteur. So I think maybe in past years they would have had a slightly easier job of it. Or to put it another way, I don't think Scorsese could ever have gotten Kundun made today. But then again, he's going to make Silence, which has been a passion project of his for years. So he hasn't given up on it. But it doesn't surprise me that it's difficult for them. It seems like the only people that it's really difficult for, that it's not difficult for, are the ones that are just like, let me play the franchise game. I'm going to hop in. I'm going to do the thing. Like, I don't know. I haven't ever heard like Paul W.S. Anderson being like, man, there's a passion project out there of mine that I really want to get done. But man, if you need me to do more Resident Evil movies, although he's making Pompeii right now. Ooh, boy.
Yeah. And Roland Emmerich made Anonymous. So
Roland Emmerich got to, he made Anonymous. So there you go.
But I think you look at these like legendary directors, but they have had films that haven't done that well. But I think the reason, I mean, it's obvious that the reason Christopher Nolan is basically given a bunch of money and left alone is because he's making billion-dollar movies. Like, Inception was his original idea, and I'm sure Warner Brothers was – I mean, I know that he leveraged coming back for Dark Knight Rises with letting him make Inception. But I think once that movie like played like gangbusters, they were like, oh, I'm sorry, you can do whatever you want.
No, he'll be golden until he's not. Until until some if Interstellar flops, whoo boy.
Which I don't see any reason.
I don't see any reason either. But it's just it's that kind of thing where you're eventually
Eventually the train's got to stop.
For me, the only director who I enjoy every single one of their movies, and this is just me personally speaking, is Tarantino, who actually does become more successful with each film. Like, I mean, I think Django is his most was his biggest box office hit, right?
Yeah, it's his biggest hit.
And then
yeah.
But before that, wasn't Inglourious his biggest hit? Like,
I think so.
Yeah, so he's just getting more you know, it's just taking longer, but I think all of his films are good, but there are flops do come. And Spielberg, I mean, that came earlier in his career and it humbled him, and then he got back up and so on and so forth. But I definitely agree with you. Like, there's this talent that is moving away because they want that artistic freedom to be that they're finding on television, because mm-hmm. the budgets that they're looking for, and also, and movie theaters could never give them this. So, but long form storytelling.
Now the new thing is they're calling it limited series, but the mini series is back. So filmmakers
now we're
go,
calling them limited series. Because
yeah,
we're
it's
assholes.
It's a bunch of smokescreen, but basically filmmakers can go with the confidence that they can finish out a story that they want to start. They don't have to go and like start something and then leave, and kind of their name's always attached to it, and they got to check in. And I mean, David Slade, I know, was super involved in the first season of Hannibal. He directed, I think, 3 out of the 10 episodes, and was an involved really heavily as an executive producer in developing the visual style of that, and obviously he hasn't made a film since, so I think he took you know, those months out of his schedule to just work exclusively on Hannibal.
Yeah, and there's a show I need to watch.
You do.
I do need to watch. Well, man, we should just do another podcast about me being angry at NBC for like having a show I really want to watch and then not putting all of the episodes out there, just the 4 most recent episodes. That
they want you to buy the DVDs.
Fuck you, NBC. Fuck you. No, I probably, you know, what I'll probably do is just like buy the episodes individual. But again, like we didn't talk about this, is piracy. Piracy is another reason people stay home. Mm. And I don't think piracy is a problem. I think the MPAA is going about dealing with it in a horrible, draconian fashion that will not benefit them, and it is in a way that follows the historical paradigm of how they always met new technology, which is when television came along, they tried to kill it, and then they're like, wait, we can make a lot of money from this, and so they did. And then when VCR came, and then when VHS came along, they're like, holy shit, we need to kill this. And then they found out a way to make a lot of money out of it, and so they did. And now it's digital, and they're freaking out again, and my assumption is they will once again figure out how to make money off of it. And they're trying, and it's difficult, but I feel that piracy is still an issue for people who don't want to wait the 3 months, and they're like, I want it now. And I'm sure that's keeping some people home. I don't think it is a huge – I think if we were to look at it percentage-wise, it wouldn't be a large percentage, but it is something that's out there. I don't think movie theaters will die because you pirated a film. You shouldn't do it.
No.
You shouldn't download a pirate. I mean, you shouldn't do it, but there are going to be a lot of other factors. If your local movie theater closes, it'll be for many, many factors, that just being a minor one.
Yeah, I feel like that was a bigger issue years ago. I personally, like, I don't know anyone who, like, I don't even know how you would go about downloading a film off the internet. Like, I've never done it. I don't know anyone who is kind of up on those things. I mean, I was around when Napster was first invented, and I remember downloading songs off that. Like, I was
Kazaa,
and LimeWire.
Poor sweet Adam and his, piracy ignorance.
That's what I wonder. Is it a generational thing? Is it just like teenagers, or are, like, there are a bunch of like 30-somethings getting around and downloading the Avengers and just like...
Oh, there are. No, I mean, there's definitely people of all ages who can see something that they want to take and they don't have to pay for it, and then they can either rationalize it for themselves, or like they'll just be like, fuck it, I didn't want to pay, and just watch it anyway. Because there are ways to get it. There's more than one way to get it. I'm not going to share them on this podcast, but they are out there. It is possible. But let me put it this way. For the security people at my press screenings who tell the audience, we have night vision goggles. And they do. And the studio is so paranoid at some screenings, they'll ask people to put their cell phones in plastic bags and take a little ticket, and then after the screening, they can come back. This is all for press screenings. So these are screenings before the film is opened. Like, if you were to just go on opening night and record it with your cell phone then, I don't know if there's a cell phone out there that can record a feature-length film, but I suppose anything's possible. Then there's no mechanism in place to stop you. But if you're going to see a movie on the Tuesday before it opens, the security hammer comes down, and you know they're very gung-ho about protecting against piracy, but honestly, what they need to worry about is the guy at midnight. And it's one of those things where the studios don't really know how to deal with it yet, because they don't understand technology. But
that just ties
I feel though that
ushers get ushers. Like,
no,
I
get
comes
it.
Full circle back to like it's on the theaters. Like have an usher in every single screening checking in. If someone's on their phone texting, it's gonna fix that. And if someone's on their phone recording
well,
the movie, it's gonna
fix that. That's the thing with the piracy problem. Like it's taking your eye off the ball to something that's actually not harming. I mean, it's harmful, but not as much as you may think. And what's harming you are people, you know, finding your product not as worthwhile. And I understand, though, they're trying to keep up with the market that they created. Like, we're not going to see DVD windows pushed back for, like, it's not going to expand now where the current average for a movie coming from theater to DVD is about 4 months. We're not going to see it where the average now becomes 6 months. That's not going to expand. It's going to contract even more so. And then there's VOD, which is also taking a bite out of it, and there's just all these different factors. And again, it goes back to our point about the number of options people have. And I feel that the MPAA and NATO aren't working together to figure out a constructive way to keep people in the theater. That there's things they can't control. They can't control the amount of entertainment options, but they can control making the movie-going experience better. And especially NATO, and they're not doing it. So that's sort of my feeling, is that if the experience is becoming worse and worse, then I think that will perhaps contribute to the implosion more than if, let's say, the Lone Ranger tanks. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes sense.
But again, this is sort of my pet issue. I mean, I care about other things as well. I don't want to be like, and nothing else in the world is wrong. But I do feel passionately about this, and I'm glad that we talked about it. Not that we could have talked about Monsters University and World War Z, but I enjoyed this conversation more. Adam, did you find this more interesting?
Yeah, I like talking about movies. I think it's an interesting issue, and I'm the eternal optimist, so I read all these articles about how the like industry is imploding, and you know all the filmmakers moving to television. But then I see that like Warner Brothers gave Guillermo del Toro $250 million to make a Monsters versus
Robots.
He's
not Michel Gondry, Adam. He can't make a blockbuster out of $250.
And then even like someone like Alfonso Cuarón, who gets to make Gravity, who I can only imagine that thing's amazing. So I mean, I think there's hope. There's hope yet, and the thing is, we've just got to get people to support these kinds of films,
and learn how to.
If everyone only turns up for Fast and Furious 6, there's only going to be Fast and Furious movies in the theaters. So
right, and when you go to the theater, please behave like a decent person and respect that if people having their cell phones out was normal, everyone would have their cell phones out, but it's not. So you're the asshole in the room. Anyway, going to recommendations, Adam, what do you have for us?
Well, in keeping with kind of the – I mean, we talked earlier about, you know, the lack of movie stars and stuff like that, and that was a very different era. But I'm recommending a film from 1953. It's a musical called The Bandwagon. It stars Fred Astaire as kind of an aging or kind of washed-up stage and screen star who decides that in order to kind of revamp his image and get his career back on track, he should head back to the stage and star in a new stage show that's been written specifically for him to star in. And it turns out that the stage show that he's in, the director wants to turn it into like a pretentious retelling of Faust, and it gets kind of ridiculous. It's really funny, and it gets kind of dark, and you know, in keeping with the you know classical Hollywood musicals, the theme of the film, it you know turns around. The folks really just want to see a nice song and dance, so let's turn this back into something really fun. Really put on a show, guys. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, it stars Sid Charisse, it's directed by Vincente Minnelli, who directed Meet Me in St. Louis and American in Paris and The Pirate. I mean, I'm a sucker for musicals anyway, but this one's really, really fun. This is where the song That's Entertainment comes from, and it's a backstage musical, so, I mean, if you're interested in the film business at all, and if you're a cinephile, you will probably find this interesting, because it all takes place behind the scenes, and you're seeing this stage show turn quickly into this crazy director's vision of this dark story about the devil tempting someone, and it just kind of goes ridiculous, but it's got all the glitz and glamour of those Hollywood musicals. It's got the big production numbers. Fred Astaire's great in it. It's towards the end of his career, so he's a little older in this one, but he's still great. And Sid Charisse is gorgeous. So it's called The Bandwagon. Definitely check it out. I've seen it on TCM quite a few times, so you can probably find it on there if you just search your DVR. But if you're in the mood for something fun, something interesting, and a little older, kind of expand your movie horizons, I definitely suggest checking out The Bandwagon.
Okay, excellent. I will recommend The Purple Rose of Cairo, Woody Allen's 1985 film. It stars Mia Farrow as a young waitress living in New Jersey during the Depression. She's trapped in a horrible marriage, and so her life is pretty crummy, and so what she does is she spends a lot of her days going to the movie theater as an escape. And so the film she starts going to see a lot of is called The Purple Rose of Cairo. And in the film, Jeff Daniels plays a guy named Ton Baxter, who's sort of an archaeologist, and he lives through this, you know, sort of a madcap New York lifestyle. And it's romance, and it helps her just adjust. And then, so she keeps going to it, and then one time, she's watching it, and the character, Jeff Daniels' character, breaks the fourth wall and starts talking to her, and they start falling in love. And then there's a new twist set up when it turns out that other characters in the film realize, wait, we can also leave the movie? Like, they start interacting. This creates a huge problem for the movie studio. And to sort of trace it all the way back, they get the actor who played Tom, also Jeff Daniels, they get this guy, Gil Shepard, to go and try to get Mia Farrow's character to sort of, I don't want to say come back to reality, but they want to right the ship. And it's funny, it's romantic. I think it's one of Woody Allen's best. And it's a really interesting film about how we lose ourselves in movies and we create these relationships that feel, you know, there are people out there, and I think that if you ask them, you know, what are your strongest relationships? And I think for some people they would be like, it was a relationship to a fictional character. And obviously this would be literature or television. But movies, you get, again, it's that space, you get lost in it. And I think Purple Rose of Cairo also has sort of a wry critique on how people become obsessed with movie stars through their characters. There's that sort of aspect about a love of cinema and this sort of bittersweet relationship to it, and how even when we feel burned by it, we just get drawn back and back and can still lose ourselves in it. And so again, in a podcast I'm about what I feel that I'm missing when I go out to movies outside of my little bubble, which is that the inability to lose myself because of the way other people are behaving because they're not losing themselves in the movie, I find a film like Purple Rose of Cairo incredibly appealing. So Purple Rose of Cairo is my recommendation. Thank you for listening, everyone. Next week, the big films are White House Down and The Heat. I have some things that I might be interested in saying about The Heat. We haven't really – I'd love to have I need to see if she'll join us, but I hope she will. I won't say who. But I like to talk about women, and we haven't really talked about that a lot. And
this is the only female-led franchise movie this summer, isn't it?
It is. It's first female.
Well, not franchise, but
movie. Exactly. And also, it's an action film, and it's an R-rated comedy. And the reason that one of the reasons I also wanted to talk about it was we gave away passes to The Heat for the Atlanta screening. Usually when it's a movie, it's like pretty even. It's about half and half about men and women trying to get passes. Heat, majority women trying to get passes for this, which I thought was interesting. Now, obviously, that's just anecdotal, but it's another thing, and I think it's definitely worth talking about. So hopefully we'll focus in on that. I would prefer to have a female guest so it's not just three dudes talking about women in cinema, because I always feel kind of out of my depth. It's like, well, I'll tell you what it's like to be a woman today watching movies if you'll just give me a moment. Boy, yeah, I don't want to be that guy. So we'll bring on someone. We can find someone. I know a lot of great female film critics, and hopefully one of them will be available to join us. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, you can keep up with us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. And Adam, where can we find you?
Adam Chitwood.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.